Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
The U.S. and the current regime in Afghanistan have made, unfortunately, very unsavory alliances with war criminals.
We revisit a wartime atrocity in Afghanistan that has been acknowledged by officials, though the perpetrators of this crime have not been held accountable. In 2002, the group Physicians for Human Rights shocked the world with their discovery of a mass grave site where an unknown number of suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters were buried. Some estimate as many as 2,000 prisoners in the custody of U.S. allies suffocated while being moved across Afghanistan in metal shipping containers. Some were reportedly shot. Physicians for Human Rights has long sought protection for the gravesite and investigations into those who are buried there, but they're now urgently calling on Afghan leaders, U.S. commanders, and NATO forces to protect the site in the vicinity of Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan. Deputy Director of Physicians for Human Rights, Susanna Serkin, joins us to discuss recent developments. This gravesite was disturbed, and bodies appear to have been removed. After this interview, we'll have a brief update on Gaza. Susanna Serkin, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Physicians for Human Rights has long been calling for both protection of these sites and also an investigation. How many people are thought to be buried, and what can you tell us about how they died?
Well, I wish we knew more about precisely how they died or how many are in the grave, but I can tell you what we have seen reported by many reliable sources. This grave was discovered by Physicians for Human Rights researchers at the beginning of January 2002, shortly after the end of the major phase of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, working with the Northern Alliance. The grave was discovered when a couple of our researchers were in the northern Afghanistan town of Mazar-e-Sharif, which is an area at the time and to this day controlled to a great extent by a well-known Afghan warlord, General Dostum. Our researchers had discovered horrific conditions in a prison called the Shebargan prison, which is just outside of Mazar-e-Sharif. And the prisoners in this prison, there were hundreds who were, according to the warden, dying at the rate of 10 to 15 a day of malnutrition, illness, and exposure because it's cold up there and it's the winter and they had very little clothing. So some of those prisoners had been cherry-picked from that prison and later taken to Guantanamo, and some of them had previously been taken to Guantanamo. When our researchers were there, they saw this large area in the desert that appeared to have human bones on the surface and a lot of discarded clothing and some disturbed earth. And these researchers, who were doctors, not forensic scientists, alerted Physicians for Human Rights that it looked like an area of a mass grave. A couple of months later, in early 2002, two forensic specialists went back and indeed documented that this was, to all appearances, the scene of a possibly very large mass grave, or site of a large mass grave, and they recommended that it be officially investigated. During the same year, and at the same time, people started receiving reports from eyewitnesses to incidents in this area that a very large number of bodies had been thrown by trucks into this grave site, and that the trucks carrying these bodies had come across northern Afghanistan from the location of the fall, sort of the last surrender of those who were battling U.S. forces and the Northern Alliance, Taliban and random other forces, including probably Al-Qaeda fighters, etc. These soldiers or fighters had surrendered to the Northern Alliance and U.S. special forces. U.S. forces were working as allies with General Dostum's forces. And reportedly, these surrendered fighters, many hundreds, were put into sealed container trucks where, according to reports, they suffocated to death in transit. Some of them reportedly were also shot and dumped in this gravesite area known as Dashti Leili. Physicians for Human Rights was able to go back to the site in 2002 and conduct, under the auspices of the United Nations in Afghanistan, a preliminary removal of 15 human remains or exposure of 15 remains and an exhumation and autopsy on three of those bodies. And the remains were recently buried, meaning within the previous 6 months, this narrative that it had been received from eyewitnesses. And the three bodies that our doctors, forensic scientists, autopsied, their deaths were consistent with suffocation. So at that time, back in 2002, Physicians for Human Rights called for a full securing of this site, protection of the site, and a full investigation. At the time, also, there were reports that more than 1,000 bodies were thus dumped into this grave. And that's the story from back then. It was then followed up by an incredible investigation by Newsweek magazine in August 2002 that advanced these reports and documented them quite thoroughly of these containered deaths, deaths by suffocation in these trucks of surrendered prisoners, which would be, if all true, a very serious war crime, an extreme violation, grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, because prisoners who surrender are supposed to be due all the rights and protections and safeties of the Geneva Convention. And here we'd had a story of, you know, more than 1,000 people suffocated to death following surrender.
I remember in 2001 how shocking this story was. And one of the other interesting aspects of it had to do with the history of the region, America's role in supporting some of the members of the Northern Alliance who had these very dark histories. One of them, you talked about Dostum, but there was also Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the arms dealer who's floated between the Afghan and Pakistan borders for some many years now, but was supported by the U.S. during the U.S. opposition to the Russians in Afghanistan. So just talk about how this story opened the door on the future, the possible dark future for Afghanistan in general, as the U.S. began to develop old ties again and old problems of being caught between these very dangerous forces.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, in the way that the U.S. conducted its war in Afghanistan, and even in the buildup of supporting those who first opposed the Soviet invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, and then in preparation for and during and then subsequent to the war in 2001, the U.S. and the current Afghan government have made alliances with people who have enormous amounts of blood on their hands. And Physicians for Human Rights is focused in particular on this grave because although we've worked on other graves in Afghanistan and have been calling for full protection and eventual documentation of all the mass graves over the past, let's say, 30 years in Afghanistan, this grave is of particular interest because of the very close United States connection, at least according to all the narratives that we have, to the crimes alleged to have been related to the fate of these captured prisoners. But in the process of the U.S. policy to democratize, stabilize, whatever you want to call it, in Afghanistan, the U.S. and the current regime in Afghanistan have made, unfortunately, a very unsavory alliance with war criminals.
Does the stealing of the bodies appear to have anything to do with the political climate in the region and the changing U.S. role as Barack Obama gets ready to take office?
Physicians for Human Rights has been working, as I mentioned, on a process to try to document and photograph all the major mass grave sites across Afghanistan from all of the conflicts of the last period, because we believe that peace can never really occur without a transitional justice process, without people knowing the truth of what has happened to their loved ones in society, and without those responsible for crimes being held accountable. So in the course of that project, one of our researchers, our investigators, went up in the late summer to see this site and noticed that there were very large holes and that there had been marks of heavy machinery. And subsequently, others have now attested to the fact that this grave has been dramatically altered, that vast amounts of soil have been removed from the grave, very likely obliterating evidence of a very possible massive war crime. According to McClatchy News, 2 weeks ago, General Dostum is responsible for this destruction, alleged destruction of this grave. I really can't speculate as to the timing of it. It's very unfortunate that a lot of evidence from this grave has now been destroyed. we, Physicians for Human Rights, are calling urgently for the United Nations, the Afghan government, other forces in the area who might be in a position to secure the site, to secure and protect the site, and to conduct a full investigation after 7 years into these incidents leading to this grave. And certainly now to also find out who destroyed the site and what has been done if there were large numbers of remains removed. In the past year and a half, Physicians for Human Rights also filed a Freedom of Information Act request to the U.S. government, to all branches of the U.S. government, DOD, Department of Defense, and State Department, requesting all information that the U.S. government had pertaining to this site. We did not receive a response to it, and finally we filed suit to get a response to our Freedom of Information Act request. And lo and behold, in the last several months, starting in the summer, we began to receive responses. And one of the most revealing responses came from the State Department report citing U.S. intelligence sources indicating that indeed, very likely 2,000 bodies of prisoners were in that grave, and also indicating that the United States knew through U.S. intelligence sources, again, those sources are redacted, so we don't know what the sources are. They were blocked out in the FOIA response that we received. But the U.S. Clearly knew that a number of eyewitnesses who had seen the bodies or said that they had seen these bodies dumped and seen the container trucks, et cetera, were later disappeared, tortured, and executed. So the stakes are very high in this case, and we really hope and are appealing, actually, now that the Obama administration will have a different policy on looking at the truth and, even if necessary, holding our own government accountable for its relationship to these incidents and certainly its responsibility to investigate.
There is one note in the documents you did receive under FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, and the State Department officials were documenting intelligence. And then there is this kind of small note where they talk about the fact that regional leaders are very sensitive to international scrutiny about the gravesite and to reports of atrocities by the Afghan military. They suggest commanders take every opportunity to remind observers, that could mean the Physicians for Human Rights organization for one, that the Taliban were the primary abusers. And they suggest a balancing of investigations into this atrocity with information on atrocities committed by the Taliban. Now, that might provide some rationale for some readers, but with revenge as a possibility between these very, in some cases, extreme individuals and groups, what does that type of response tell you about the way the U.S. role comes into this region and could be as much a provocative entity as one promoting peace or security?
Yeah, no, there are clearly a lot of very complex political and security issues relating to, let's say, dredging up the past here, quite literally. One of the problems that Physicians for Human Rights had back in 2002 when we called for an investigation of this site was that even the main representative of the United Nations in Afghanistan and many policy experts as well as U.S. government advisors said, if you start looking into this stuff, you're just going to provoke problems. We're going to create instability in this very delicate dance that President Karzai is playing. The theory of sort of stabilization of Afghanistan internally was to basically bring these warlords who have notorious histories of massacres into the government and, in effect, either co-opt them or give them their dues, but really forge a government across Afghanistan that would deal with all of the different players. And then, you know, with a common enemy being the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. You know, now I think I'm not an expert on this, so I don't want to put myself out to be speculating on the very complex politics around this, but our position has been all along that you cannot build a future based on an unwillingness to deal with people and leadership and a history of atrocities. And so as difficult as this might be, our position has always been and continues to be, whether it's in the past under the Bush administration or in the future under the Obama administration, that unless the UN and the Afghan government and supporters of that government, which include the United States, among others, because there are other governments that are also, you know, in NATO that have been supporting this, unless they deal with these kinds of atrocities, unless they develop a real justice system, and unless they demonstrate to the Afghan people that there's going to be an end to impunity. And we've seen this time and time again in other countries where the international players and the governments in question have failed to address atrocities of this sort. And so there has to be some kind of truth-telling in order to have any kind of legitimacy moving forward, and also to address the Taliban as well. The Vision for Human Rights, ironically, put out a major report just prior to 9/11 on women's rights under the Taliban, where we absolutely blasted the Taliban regime for its atrocious treatment of women in every respect in terms of their rights. So we have no love lost on the Taliban regime, but at the same time, those victims from Dashti, who were allegedly buried in Dashti Leili, the prisoners who surrendered, they also have rights. And any government needs to understand that whether people are your friend or foe, and we've learned this, heaven knows, from the Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo incidents, they deserve rights, and you can't base any future without respecting rights.
I know it was originally in the press that some survivors were transferred to Shabargan Prison. Has Physicians for Human Rights been able to locate any, and have you been able to follow up on any people that might have been picked up? I think that originally all of the people, you know, mentioned have tended to be from Kunduz. They were picked up in that area.
It was after this fall of one of the last strongholds during the war of Kunduz that these prisoners all surrendered and were handed over to General Gossam's forces with the U.S. present. What we don't know is to what extent the U.S. was present following that on. But the answer to your question is no, we Physicians for Human Rights do not have contact and have not had communication, I don't believe, with survivors. But I only know from the press account that there are alleged to have been survivors. One of the challenges of all of this is that clearly we know from the story that some witnesses were executed, that one needs to be very careful with anyone or about anyone who knows anything about this horrific, this alleged horrific incident. It's also interesting that General Dostum in the last few weeks has appeared in Turkey. We know this only from the media, but he's believed to be there. And there's speculation about whether he will stay there or go back to Afghanistan. But one wonders what his future situation would or should be with the range of alleged crimes that he may be responsible for out there now.
Barack Obama, when he was announcing his security team to include Defense Secretary Gates, mentioned Afghanistan.
As Bob said not too long ago, Afghanistan is where the war on terror began, and it is where it must end. And going forward, we will continue to make the investments necessary to strengthen our military and increase our ground forces to defeat the threats of the 21st century.
Susanna Serkin, do you think the U.S. has, in fact, the ability to close off some of these very dark connections America has made? I mean, we have been bombing Pakistan, and it seems, if anything, the wars are intensifying in that more and more players are taking complex roles. Can Barack Obama defuse this situation, or do you see it escalating? And if so, what does Physicians for Human Rights call on Barack Obama to do here?
What we've called on Bush to do and what we will call on Obama to do are the same regarding this particular site and regarding past atrocities in Afghanistan. And we recognize that it's a very sensitive and delicate situation there, but I think it will take an act of a great political vision and courage to change this policy, to work with the Karzai government to, in a careful but deliberate way, demonstrate to the Afghan people and to the world that these are not the policies that represent democracy, human rights, stability, and a good future for that country or for the United States. And there's got to be a way to shed this past, to end impunity, to investigate even U.S. responsibilities that were shirked and or potential U.S. collusion in this crime, as massive as it may be. And I think with a new president, there is a chance for President Obama to distance himself from that. Of course, it will be harder with, you know, the same Secretary of Defense, but Gates was not the Secretary of Defense in 2002, so that may also augur well for dealing with. We have had interesting reports, also, again, only in the press, no direct contact, I don't believe, that there may be some willingness from the U.S. and or NATO to protect this site and investigate. And we, Physicians for Human Rights and others, and I hope the United Nations in Afghanistan will continue to call for that, and to get the Afghan government as well every kind of assistance they can to secure what evidence remains and go forward with a full and open and honest investigation.
Finally, Susanna Serkin, at the Physicians for Human Rights Office, there's a long history of investigating things like atrocities, mass graves. Just give us a little overview of Physicians for Human Rights, their history in the Balkans and other parts of the world, what your mandate really is, and how people can learn more about you.
Yes, thank you. Well, Physicians for Human Rights was founded in 1986, and our goal has been always to promote health as a human right and also to bring the skill and capacities and advocacy of the health professions to the cause of human rights in the United States and globally. We have a large range of programs from working on women's rights and health to health and human rights in times of conflict to investigating mass atrocities like this using our forensic expertise. And our international forensic program has worked under the auspices of international criminal tribunals to document mass graves in Bosnia, the Srebrenica massacres, for instance, as well as in Rwanda and in many other countries. And this is a very significant portion of our work. And people who are interested in our work, and we survive based on the support of members and individuals, and you don't have to be a health professional to participate in our work, but people can learn more about us by looking at our website at www.physiciansforhumanrights.org.
Susanna Serkin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Susanna Serkin, Deputy Director of Physicians for Human Rights. Their website is physiciansforhumanrights.org, and you can find reports on the Dasht Alili mass grave site and other areas of their international war crimes research there. We turn now to Gaza, where the Israeli military continued to launch attacks January 7th, day 11 of their air and ground war. The UN and a growing number of world leaders are pushing Israel and Hamas to accept a ceasefire plan being negotiated through Egypt and Turkey, with involvement from the French president now, Nicolas Sarkozy. Palestinians have accepted the ceasefire plan. However, Hamas appears to be getting shut out of the discussion. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas is planning on a visit to Cairo for talks. Israel's ambassador to the UN said they were taking ceasefire offers seriously. However, Reuters' Paul Chapman closed his news segment about the possibilities for a ceasefire with an ominous note about Israel's plans.
As the proposals for a limited truce are examined, Israeli ministers are discussing whether to order a final escalation of the conflict by sending troops deep into Gaza's cities and refugee camps.
President-elect Barack Obama spoke about Gaza briefly at a press conference, but he put strong statements about what he feels U.S. policy should be off until after the inauguration.
The loss of civilian life in Gaza and in Israel is a source of deep concern to me. And after January 20th, I'm going to have plenty to say about the issue, and I am not backing away at all from what I said during the campaign, that I, starting at the beginning of our administration, we are going to engage effectively and consistently in trying to resolve the conflicts that exist in the Middle East.
There were massive demonstrations in Israel with some 10,000 people turning out in the streets of Tel Aviv. Israeli peace activist Uri Avneri prepared a statement to be read. However, speeches were canceled due to the presence of extreme right militants who staged a riot at the event. Uri Avneri's remarks included strong statements about Israeli politicians. "The war is criminal," he wrote, "because it is, on top of everything else, openly and shamelessly part of Ehud Barak's and Tzipi Livni's election campaign." Barak is Israel's defense minister. Livni is head of the Kadima party and running for the office of prime minister. Uri Avneri went on to say, I accuse Ehud Barak of exploiting the IDF soldiers in order to get more Knesset seats. I accuse Tzipi Livni of advocating mutual slaughter in order to become prime minister. I accuse Ehud Olmert of trying to cover up rot and corruption with a disastrous war. We spoke with Josh Rubner last week. He's National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, and we'll end today's program with some of the background information he provided on Gaza that we couldn't include last week.
Well, I think to give what's happening in the Gaza Strip today some context, we need to look back 60 years, actually, to when the State of Israel was created. Approximately two-thirds of the residents of the Gaza Strip today are refugees or descendants of refugees who were expelled or forced to flee from their homes when Israel was created and who have not been allowed to return back to their houses by Israel in defiance of international law. So the density of population of people in the Gaza Strip is largely the result of them being herded into this small territory by Israel and kept there oftentimes against their will and without the ability to return to their houses. So that's why you see this dense concentration of people. Since 1967, Israel has been in belligerent military occupation of the Gaza Strip. In 2005, it withdrew its illegal settlements from the Gaza Strip, but that does not mean that it ended its occupation of this territory. In fact, Israel throughout, since 1967, has maintained a land, air, and sea siege of the Gaza Strip that's had terrific, horrible impact on the humanitarian situation of the people living in the Gaza Strip. And that siege has intensified since 2005 when Israel withdrew its settlements from the Gaza Strip, but it's particularly intensified since 2006 when Hamas won the Palestinian legislative elections. Now, we need to keep in mind that these elections were encouraged by both the United States and Israel. So for the United States and Israel to be backing this siege and devastating attack on the Gaza Strip is really hypocritical and really bespeaks the non-commitment that Israel and the United States actually have to promoting democracy in the region.
Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. If you were in a dialogue with some of these organizations or with U.S.-based Jews who are supporting this action by the Israeli military, what might you invite them to consider as they try and understand the whole process, and how might you respond to their arguments?
First, I think it's very important to point out that there was a demonstration in Tel Aviv of Israelis against the invasion and war on the Gaza Strip, and a number of Jewish American organizations have also condemned it and put out calls for an urgent and immediate ceasefire, including groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, the Jewish Alliance for Justice. So it would be a mistake to think that the response has been monolithic, but nevertheless, you are correct that a large number of these mainstream organizations, as always, support whatever the Israeli government does, including the commission of war crimes. You know, I don't know if all people can be convinced and talked to. There are people who will support evil acts of governments, you know, no matter what you try to tell them and rationalize to them. But it can never be legitimate to support war crimes and crimes against humanity. And that's what's taking place in the occupied Gaza Strip right now. And people who are supporting those actions should be ashamed of themselves and should have a heavy moral burden on their consciences.
For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.